Hello, and welcome to episode 102 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Bill Turk, Maryland staff of the Washington Post. Bill, how are you doing today?
Good, how are you?
Excellent. The first question I'd like to ask you is, what are you currently doing to advance the public interest, or have you ever done to advance the public interest, and why?
Well, I like to think that that practicing journalism does help advance the public interest, not with each and every particular story, but over the long term. I think that I and my colleagues believe that accountability helps advance things, and that people have to be held accountable. Public people, public officials need to be held accountable for their actions. We need to measure what's promised versus what's delivered. So that is all, that's how I feel like I make a difference.
How did it become apparent to you that it would be your role to hold politicians accountable?
It just evolved over time. It was 40 years ago that I had my first newspaper job. I was a summer intern at the Kansas City Star. And I can't tell you that I started that whole trip because I was interested in, making an impact in the world. I just thought it was a fun thing to do. But over time, I began to understand the power of good journalism, and I began to understand how it could set an agenda and drive events.
Now, what proportion of your stories would you say in any given week or month or period of time are actually holding elected officials accountable? I'm sure there may be stories that you write that are not, are all of your stories holding?
No.
Okay. I
mean, a lot of them are, the main mission is just to, you provide people information to illuminate what's going on.
Right.
So they can make decisions about things, about who to vote for, about, where they want to send their kids to school. I would, it's hard to put a percentage on it, but those are they're important stories that hold people accountable, but they're not frequent,
So what is the bulk of what you write about?
Keeping people up on what their public officials are doing and why they're doing it, and
do you write almost exclusively about elected officials then?
More or less, yeah, right now it's government and politics, so there's a pretty heavy dose of that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so if there's no malfeasance that you're writing about on any particular day, you're trying to keep people informed.
Right. I mean, you want to tell them, is the county council thinking about raising their property taxes, or is the county executive going to veto a particular piece of legislation? Or you're telling multiple narratives as you go along about particular issues. There's a big vote on the minimum wage that's coming up next week, the $15 minimum wage, and so that has all
in Montgomery County.
Yes, and so there's all sorts of smaller narratives that you're following that sort of feed sometimes into larger things. Like one of the main themes I think here in Montgomery County is the urbanization of the county. And the county has evolved from a very traditional sort of bedroom suburb into something else, into a very surprisingly diverse, urbanizing place. With several big urban nodes: Bethesda, Silver Spring, Gaithersburg, to a certain extent. It's a majority-minority county, so a lot of the things that I end up writing about tend to sort of touch on that theme. There's anxiety about more construction in certain places. People who bought homes here bought in also to a certain idea and a certain vision of what they wanted the county to be, and they did not want to live in an urban or even semi-urban area.
Sure.
So that's one of the main things.
So within the context of increasing density and urbanization in a majority-minority a county where it's now the population is exceeding a million people, it used to be much smaller, it used to be majority Caucasian, now it's changing, I guess, what are, within that context, what are some of the stories that you've written about that have held power accountable? Like, in what context did power need to be, or is power needing to be, held accountable to date?
Well, let me think. There was a very nasty debate a few months ago over a neighborhood called West Bard.
Right.
And there was a, you know, considerable debate on the council over whether to allow the modernization of a big shopping center on West Bard Avenue.
And is there any mass transit near the West Bard development?
Not really. It's funny, they'll say, well, it's near mass transit, so that, but it's not really a walk that anybody can make. There's a bus, there's buses, but not, it's not really serious mass transit.
So that's the crux of that issue, which is, should there be development without adequate mass transit infrastructure, or should you build mass transit infrastructure and then allow development?
Well, there's part of that. The other theme of it was that this area was not really due for a reconsidered master plan, that it was a response to a private developer coming in and say, hey, we want to do this, and we're going to buy this piece of land. Can we get the zoning in a particular way?
Mm-hmm.
And so part of the story was looking at the kind of delicate sort of dance between people who make land use plans for the county and people who build things. And
so was the question that you were trying to address as a reporter whether the elected officials, which in this case would be the 9 county council members from Montgomery County and the county executive, are they making decisions to allow increased density and development because it is in the public's interest, or is it because that they get campaign contributions potentially from developers and it's in the developer's interest? Is that what you're trying to get at?
Yeah, that is one of the sort of foundational sort of realities.
On whose behalf are these elected officials making this decision?
Right. The vast majority of, the considerable majority of campaign contributions that elected officials get here are from the real estate community. Not just developers, but attorneys for developers, real estate people, architects, surveyors, engineers. There's a whole industry here because the main regulatory responsibility of the council is land use. That's what they do.
Now, when you do report on these individuals, now in the state of Maryland, politicians are required to report all campaign contributions that they receive to the Maryland Board of Elections. Mm-hmm. And this is public information.
Mm-hmm.
So do you ever find it relevant for your readers to include what campaign which members received campaign contributions from developers and which didn't? Because maybe someone who didn't receive a contribution is actually approving something that's in the interest of developers because they think that's in the public interest and it just happens to align. Do you ever report on their contributions and provide that context for readers?
I try to, yeah. It's never it's rarely a clear-cut sort of thing because, first of all, you never really know, and nor will ever be able to prove that a quid pro quo has taken place.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be other reasons, and there often are other reasons, multiple reasons, that a council member will vote in a particular way.
Mm-hmm.
It may be that, a contributor has an interest in something. He may think the council member may also just think it's a good idea on its own merits.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the tricky thing about campaign contributions. You want to get that information out there, but it's rarely sort of conclusive or dispositive about why a decision goes a certain way.
And let's say there is a individual standing right here next to us, and this individual says, I want to run for county council.
Mm-hmm.
And my platform is, I think we really need development in West Bard. So then he goes and he says, this is what's in the public interest. We really need this development. Then he solicits campaign contributions from the developers who have an interest in West Bard and receives money from them. Subsequently, he gets elected. And then while elected, he votes exactly as he had originally promised voters before he even got the campaign contributions, which was the whole reason why he got the contributions in the first place. Would that be malfeasance, or is that how he ought to act? How would you hold that individual accountable?
Well, first of all, you probably wouldn't I mean, you would not be bearing witness to a conversation like that as a reporter.
Right.
So that's one thing that would be sort of out of view. So you have to look at what's visible, which is money from a certain entity going to the candidate, certain voting behavior taking place. The problem, the whole problem is the money. And hopefully, I think, we're going to see a change in that because of this new matching funds campaign finance law that's going to kick in with the 2018 election. And it's going to allow, it's going to, I think, lessen the influence of development industry money, because it will allow people to get matching contributions from the public treasury for small individual donations from people.
Can you talk a little bit about the feedback you've gotten? Let's just stick on the story of Westbard for a moment. A feedback that you've gotten from readers about the information that you've been presenting to them. So you've been reporting, you've been trying to hold power accountable, get the information out about this Westbard development. How have readers reacted? Have they thanked you? Have they said, yes, those politicians are corrupt? They said, no, politicians are doing exactly what they want. What's the feedback that you've been getting on this particular issue?
It's mostly, it's kind of like the feedback on a lot of stories, which is that people will make their assessment based on whether they think the story affirms their particular point of view or not.
So people have preconceived notions when they begin to read the article.
Oh, yeah.
So to what extent have the series of articles that you've written about Westbard actually helped improve our democracy if people are already coming with their own notions?
I don't think Westbard is a shining example of improving democracy. I think it is. What was significant to me was about the money and also about the tone of the debate, which was especially an unusually angry, and people in that community, I thought, what I thought I was seeing was there was some of the incivility and anger that it was trickling down from the national level of debate, I thought, into the local level, which is that manifested by people not believing any data from the government, not believing anything elected officials said, always believing there was some larger conspiracy or plan at work. So that was, to me, that was also noteworthy about Westbard. And I did a story about one of the stories mentioned. I went into a thing about how, you know, it's the tone and tenor of public debate in the county has started to take on some of the raw, kind of angry sort of tones that you see in other venues.
So with emotions, you get more emotions, and you must get reactions from the subject of your writing, which is the elected officials. Can you talk a little bit about, over the course of your career, what kind of feedback you've been getting from elected officials? Do people, do they approve of your writing? Do they challenge it? Do they say you haven't gotten quite the right spin? How do the powers that you're attempting to hold account, do they thank you for doing a service as the Fourth Estate?
You know, the one thing I can say with certainty is you never know how a politician or anybody is going to react to something written about them. There are stories that I've written, and I'll think, wow, I really blew this guy's doors off. He's never going to talk to me again. And it's like nothing happened. You know, it never says anything. I don't hear anything. And then I'll write something, and someone will just become unglued over what I thought was just a trivial or, you know, peripheral matter.
Yeah.
And so you can't really predict with certainty. Most of the time, I don't hear a lot directly from the elected officials because I think that they just take a lot of it in stride, and they don't. I don't have a lot of debates with them about stuff that's been written.
When they do provide you feedback, how does that influence you?
Well, you know, if there are things that I've gotten wrong, it gets my attention, and that happens from time to time. I take all those conversations seriously, and because when you're covering a beat, you have to you know, you're trying to establish relationships with people, and you want them to keep talking to you, and you want to be fair,
mm-hmm.
and you want to be you know, pay attention to context. So I do listen carefully. Now, a lot of the stuff I listen to sometimes doesn't have much merit.
It's yeah.
mostly, a lot of it is sometimes people whining because they didn't get enough attention in the paper. Why didn't you quote me saying this? Or,
so on that topic of not being quoted enough, one of the most valuable things to it, well, we mentioned money earlier, mm-hmm. right?
Right?
And the influence of money in politics. And that begs the question, well, why is money needed in politics? What is it spent on? And of course, the answer is campaigns, which is postage stamps, airtime on radio and TV, printed ads, getting in front of the voters.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one great way to do that is earned media, which mm-hmm. is for free.
Right.
So many politicians would love to have a reporter write about them because that's free advertising.
Mm-hmm.
That is removing the money from the politics. So do you have people courting you to try to get more earned media coverage? Do you ever take into account how something you write may help somebody's campaign?
People are always asking for, you know, I get pitches all the time, not just from politicians, but for people who work for politicians or who work for nonprofits or community organizers
mm-hmm.
who want some, you know, want to get some attention for something. And I get that, and I listen to all of it. It's not, a lot of it is not possible because it's just not the best use of my time, but my time is limited.
Mm-hmm.
I have to, you're constantly making, you're triaging decisions about what to write about, because deciding to write about one thing means you're really closing the door on two or three other things in a given point in time.
So who's making the decision, you or your editors?
It's done in concert, although day to day mostly it's me. We have a fair degree of autonomy in deciding how we're going to spend our time. You know, it's always in consultation.
What's the role of the editor in determining how the news gets played up here in Montgomery County?
Well, it's changed a lot in the last few years, obviously, with social media, in that there used to be just one deadline every day, and your story either went on the front page of the Metro section or went inside the Metro section or went on the front page. All of that still goes on, but the demands and the opportunities for posting things online as the day goes on, that those decisions become less important about how they, you know, how they're going to play a story. And for good or ill, play on stories is driven by the response, by the traffic that it creates, by the interest it creates online.
So is there any pressure that you have, that you feel about not only, you know, it sounds like it used to be, and maybe it still is, that what you tried to do was report the best story you could
mm-hmm.
on deadline that holds power accountable and gives the right amount of information that's accurate to the public so that they can make informed decisions in their democracy. But of course, the newspaper business is a business. So to what extent do you face pressures to change your story, change the types of stories you cover, or if you have four stories you could potentially do on a Tuesday, which of the four? Is there, what kind of pressure do reporters, or do you in particular, feel due to the need to generate revenue for the paper and readership?
There is pressure. It's never, a lot of it is not overt or direct, but it's the culture starts to change. For example, we now have personalized dashboards that show us how our stories have done online, how long people have spent reading them.
And they're internally viewable only?
Yeah.
Okay.
And where people pick up the story. Do they come in from Facebook? Do they come in from Google? Do
right.
they come in from the homepage? You know, how many page views, how many unique visitors, all that stuff. And, yeah, it does matter. But there's also a recognition that I'm not going to generate as much traffic as somebody who's covering, you know, Donald Trump. That's just the reality.
Mm-hmm.
The universe of people that are going to read my stuff is just different. So they understand that. But, you know, there's now a growing awareness of all of us that, you know, how are our stories performing digitally. I can't honestly tell you, though, that it's changed it hasn't really changed my selection of stories. It may change the way I execute them. I may try to do them more quickly, get them online at a certain time of day.
Are stories the same word length?
A lot of times not. Sometimes they tend to be shorter, or they tend to be tailored toward when web traffic is spiking at a particular time of day, like right now is a prime time to put stuff up.
When is right now?
You know, like between 6 and 9 in the morning when people are getting up and looking at, you know, punching up the paper. There's another little peak between 10 and 11. People get to work and they've had their first cup of coffee and you see readership go up. And then it kind of lulls again, and then lunchtime it goes up. You know, it goes through a dead period in the afternoon, and then late afternoon, before people are leaving or they're waiting for traffic to clear or whatever, then it goes up again.
Yeah.
Then after 5 o'clock, it just falls off the table until the next morning.
So, okay, so your readership is changing, and it's affecting you because you have to produce potentially stories more quickly. Are you still producing one a day?
Sometimes more than that, but usually not more than one a day. It's an unusual day when I write two, but the difference is if I have a 10 o'clock hearing to go to and there's news, you know, back in the day, I could go do other things and come back and I would meet a 5 o'clock deadline or wherever. Now, the expectation is that I will have a story, you know, at least within a couple of hours of the conclusion of that hearing.
So you mentioned that a story that is on the front page of the newspaper that refers to a national presidential candidate or president-elect may get more hits than the Metro section, which to me indicates that more people are interested in that story than stories about local politicians. But your career right now is focused on reporting on those local politicians, so one may infer that you have an interest in local government. And the question is, why? Why would you have an interest in covering county council, state delegates and senators, county executive, these issues that are less appealing to readers? Why are they appealing to you?
Well, I've done a lot of things over the years. I've covered the White House. I've covered Congress. I've covered, you know, state government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is something that just kind of happened, and I was asked to do it, and I'm fine with it. I like the intimacy of it. I like the there's a small but very sort of engaged group of readers, particularly in Montgomery County. They have high expectations for local government, and you know, so there's. It's an interesting community, and I think it's a community that's far more diverse and complex than I think people outside realize, and so you're always trying to get at that. So a lot of the traffic that people those Trump stories get comes from other places. It comes from other parts of the country, other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not as if there's a whole local population that is a vast population locally that is reading the Trump stories. It's not reading Montgomery County stories. It's just that why would someone in Missoula, Montana care about, you know, what's going on here?
Right. Okay. So it's an internationally recognized newspaper that gains traffic when anyone wants to know about what's going on with the presidency of the United States,
or what's
which impacts them.
Internationally, yeah. And it's the whole strategy of the paper, you know, under Jeff Bezos now, is to become a national and international brand. And in some ways...
Become or remain?
Become. I think, and I don't say this as a criticism, I understand what they're trying to do, but I think when the Graham family sold the paper, I think Don Graham did look at the Post sort of as a local paper that did national stuff,
mm-hmm.
that was because it was in Washington, it was covering the local industry, which is government. I think that the folks that own and run the paper now view it as a national and international paper that also has retained local operations.
So if I'm at a Ritz-Carlton in Hong Kong and I go down to the concierge and I'd like to pick up a paper, I may have the London Times, New York Times, I may get the Wall Street Journal, and then potentially Mr. Bezos would like me also to see the Washington Post as a selection.
He probably wants you to see it on your tablet or on your Kindle or on your whatever. I'm not sure you're going to see a hard copy of the Post, but on mobile devices, on laptops, everything, that's where he wants the Post to project.
So we're nearing the end of this podcast, and I'd like to ask you to speak about the impact that you've had over your career, their motivation to do public service, why you chose this path for yourself, why is it that holding power accountable has been so crucial to your decision, has had such a large role in the development of your career. What really has been driving you to do public service through journalism for the majority of your career?
Well, I don't know how to answer that. All I can tell you is that it still feels fresh and interesting to me. I like telling stories. I like conveying to people what's going on around them that they may not be totally aware of.
Mm-hmm.
I like it when we drive or we shape the debate that's going on locally about issues.
Mm-hmm.
I like expanding people's understanding of officials. You know, it can be anything from a small story. I wrote a book-length treatment of Al Gore many years ago, and you know, I think that helped expand people's understanding of who this person was that was making decisions and who this candidate for president was really like,
mm-hmm.
what he was really like. So, I don't know. I don't wake up every morning and say, how am I going to hold, you know, power accountable today? You know, you try to explore what you think is going to advance the reader's understanding of what is at the top of the agenda, what is most interesting right now. And so, you know, it's advancing the reader's understanding, that's the first and foremost thing, not necessarily taking every opportunity to tweak somebody who's in power. I mean, the most important thing is what the needs of the reader are, and
mm-hmm.
what does the reader need to come to assessments or decisions about how the government is performing.
And that has been Bill Turk, Maryland staff of the Washington Post, who speaks about a variety of challenges facing an evolving and dynamic news industry in the early 21st century. Mr. Turk speaks about a readership that gets news from many different sources, who often come to the news with a preconceived notion of how they feel about a certain story. For Bill, holding power accountable is getting, as a common theme among many journalists, which is getting the facts right, getting the story right, and then allowing the electorate, the readership, to hold power accountable, armed with the information that he provides. He deals with conspiracy theories, a national trend to not believing data, and really, despite all of these various challenges facing him and his industry, Mr. Turk has developed a career in journalism that has evolved from national to local, local to national. And at the end of the day, he's trying to hold power accountable, just making sure that politicians are really making decisions that are really in at least in their own minds, in the public interest, motivated by desire to advance the public good through public policy, as opposed to serving the interests of money, which may provide a competing priority for personal self-gain. So that's Bill Turk, holding power accountable. Bill, thanks for joining us today.
It was a pleasure.
Excellent. And this has been episode 102 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time.